Warning, this podcast discusses addiction, mental health, and other sensitive topics. Please listen with care and take a break if needed. You are not alone, and support is available.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Malfunction Junction.
Thank you for joining us.
I'm Andrew.
I'm Jay.
How's everybody doing tonight? We are chilling, by the way, both of us, but we're going to start like we do every week. With our weekly check-in. Jay, how you doing this week?
I don't remember. It's been a long week. Yesterday I was sick all day. Slept in and out. Woke up a couple hours ago. Still in a bit of a sleep haze, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's been good aside from the last 2 days.
Yeah.
It's kind of offset my whole week. But how about yourself, brother?
I have been really good this week. We cast our film.
Nice.
And I'm working on with... Travis Wormwood over there at Pumpkin Hill Radio.
Yeah.
Which go check that podcast if you don't already. Check that podcast out. But yeah, so we're making a film called Night Cook.
Nice.
And I don't really want to give it away of what it's about. But it is, you seem like you have a question about what it's about.
Is it a nocturnal version of Breaking Bad?
Fuck.
I'm sorry. That's so stupid. It's so stupid.
No, it is not. It is not that. It is not a nocturnal version of Breaking Bad.
Okay, got it.
It is not Night Cook.
It's about a fat chef who stays up too late.
That's closer.
All right, that cool, closer. Cool, cool.
The guy that we got to play the lead character is not fat, but in my mind he was fat when I was writing it.
Got it. Do you have plus size representation in the script? I'm gonna be on your ass if you don't, Doug.
Yeah, no, we don't have any plus size representation in our movie.
I'll put it in my list of grievances, but I'm excited to see. Any idea when it's coming out?
So we have a. We are not even into production dates yet.
Mm-hmm.
We're still going off stuff like that, or trying to find stuff like that to be done pre-production wise.
Yeah.
It's a lot going on. And it's tough.
But you're through the first table read. That's great.
Yeah, we got the first table read done, and it went really, really well. Better than I expected it to, and that's not to say anything against the actors as much as it is. I just didn't. It was really cool to see it come to life.
And this is your first project, correct?
Kind of outside of school.
Right,
like done outside of school, yes.
Awesome.
I'm still in school, but I don't quite... I don't have the degree yet, so we're still finishing that up. Yeah, just got to get that done. But this is my first project outside of school.
Cool.
And it's a lot of fun. But yeah, so we're going to go ahead and read one of our weekly emails for y'all. We had an interesting question come up. This one, I really liked this one. It is, because I had thought about this a few weeks ago.
Yes, very thoughtful.
It was one of the first ideas that I'd had when coming up with this podcast to talk about this, because this is a hot and interesting topic. But that would be, this person says, I've been in and out of recovery the past few years, and lately I've been struggling with a recent relapse, feeling a lot of shame, and don't know how to get back on track. I want to move forward, but it's hard even to know where to start again.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could talk about what to do after a relapse. Well, and I think we both can deal with relapse in separate... both talk about relapse in separate types of ways.
Yeah, we have different variations of that for sure.
And I think that for myself, relapse with drugs and alcohol is more prevalent from my experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yours might be more mental health.
Right.
And it's... for drugs and alcohol, I have definitely experienced relapse, and it's been over stupid shit sometimes. For one time, it was over, I just got bored. When I was, I suppose 22, and I had gotten back from rehab in Texas and was back in California, and I just was like, I was working a lot and I could just to pay some bills, and I was just was like, fuck it, I'm gonna start drinking again because I was bored. It was like a week after getting out of rehab.
Yeah, I mean, unironically, boredom is a staggering cause of addiction in like rural towns and communities.
Oh, absolutely.
The lack of other things to turn to, you know, makes drugs a far more interesting option when you have, you know, fewer pastimes.
Yeah, and in my, you know, I grew up in a small town, so I was just in a small town, mm-hmm. and it was not healthy for me to be there. I need places. I mean, like, it's, look, I could probably do it now. I could probably go out in the mountains and live with, you know, my girl and just hang out and have a fucking, you know, homestead type thing. That sounds sick. But like,
yeah, the older I get, the nicer older it sounds. I get.
But like, it also doesn't sound good when I'm a kid.
Of course not.
But yeah, there were the boredom part, and then there was the next time I relapsed was getting stabbed.
Mm-hmm.
Which that one was just having fun. We were just trying to have fun and just trying to get drunk and just have a good old time. And of course that ended poorly. Not so much fun when you end up in the hospital, no matter what it's for.
No. Very traumatic experience as well.
That particular one, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
But then I also relapsed another time over a girl. Mm-hmm. I like was really into this one girl, and I was drinking a lot, and it was just a weird time in general during mm-hmm. COVID and all that. And we broke up, and I relapsed, and I spiraled pretty deep.
Was that during lockdown?
No, it was like 2021, which was not lockdown in Texas. I know that some places were still mm-hmm. like pretty locked down, but not in Texas where I was, at least at that time. But yeah, and it felt when it came to the decision of like, I'm gonna, you know, fuck it, dude, I'm gonna go drink. It was sudden. It didn't feel like there were no like. There were warning signs of, but it came like pretty quick. It came like the actual idea of like, fuck it, I don't care. It was like repeated. I mean, I guess the warning signs for me are like repeated failure. It was repeated rejection of like, whether it be the started with the girl, or maybe it even ended with the girl. I can't really quite remember, but it was just like, there were a few repeated failures, and it was just ended with like, well, fuck it then. I don't give a fuck. I'm going
to
relapse.
Right. So the decision to relapse was largely impulsive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I think tends to be a pretty common thing with relapse of almost any type. There's essentially like that breaking point. You snap and then you do something. You find largely regrettable. Mm-hmm. And what moved you back towards starting new again?
I think that back towards starting new again, it took a lot. And it took getting to, like, where, at least to the very end of it. There were a few times where I would start new just because I felt like I needed to. I knew that I had a problem with alcohol, and I knew that I had a problem with drugs, and I wanted to get rid of that problem at a young age because I knew that it was there. But I also didn't want to give up my lifestyle that I had that was, I thought was fun, I thought was, you know, dangerous, and I thought was crazy. And it was all of those things. And it was, I didn't really have a plan to live past the age of 26. When I turned 27, I really like had to think about, and really when it was 28, really, when I turned 28, when I turned 28, it was like a big, like, well, shit, what am I supposed to do now? Because like, I didn't plan to get this far. I never planned to get past 27. I was for sure going to die before that.
Yeah, you didn't travel with backpack bags.
No.
Right.
No. There's an old Hunter S. Thompson quote that says, like, something along the lines of, life is not supposed to be lived and with saving your body's, you know, essentially saving your body, but rather to swerve in broadside, you totally used up, and say, "Wow, what a ride!"
Hunter S. Thompson's the guy that used to do like coke all day while he wrote.
He's right? A man.
Okay. He seems like a fucking psychopath.
He okay. was a psychopath, but yeah, he was, yeah. He's the man. Don't you ever get that wrong.
I don't know what he wrote. I don't know if it's something that's important to my life or not. Maybe
definitely not. Probably not. It's not really.
He's a dude that was like wake up at 3:34 in the afternoon.
That was also written.
Do line of cocaine. That was, drink margarita. That's the guy though, right?
Yeah, I think that was overblown.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think he was a little over on the blow.
This lady wants to come because it was written by this chick that like was just some like investigative journal like reporter that was probably on the tabloids type thing, and she, I mean also I think this chick recently was like in the news for saying Trump raped her, but I'm pretty sure that's the same chick. I'm almost positive it's the same girl.
I thought Hunter S. Thompson was from a long ass time ago.
He died in 2004.
Oh shit!
At like age 64, I think.
So you think when she came over, he was trying to mog her and be like, "Yeah, you know."
No, I think he was trying to
pretty
be
pretty carefree.
Like, I think he was trying to be like, "I'm the shit."
Yeah, yeah.
Look
yeah,
at what my cool. life is like. It's fucking crazy. Look how much shit I get done. And it was like if he were just living like that every day, and the shit he got done is unbelievably impressive. Mm-hmm. To get anything done
of
like
course.
That, I can't get anything done like that.
No, I can't make my bed after a quarter of a joint. I don't know how the fuck he was functioning.
I can do just fine off weed, but I swear I could never function when it was just like take acid and do cocaine, and it was like wake up at like three,
yeah,
and have some sort of, I think it's Chivas. He was having some sort of like weird like champagne drink. Anyway, long as we're on the subject.
Yeah.
I immediately after a relapse, this particular listener, I mean, he mentions in there, I'm feeling a lot of shame. And there is a lot of that when I think that's a normal part of relapsing on anything and whatever your particular DOC, whether that be your own brain sometimes, because I know mm-hmm. that your talk is really with that, yep. the your own brain.
Explain DOC, please.
DOC would be your drug of choice.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yes. Mine would have been, what do you got? And, some people's is like a specific drug. Mine was never just, I just always, whatever I could get high off of.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's why I went as kind of deep as I did, but not as deep as I did in like one particular way. It was kind of just the whole world of it.
And I don't know if you've compartmentalized it enough, but you know, when you talk about the shame, do you think that it was predominantly from internal, like your self-identity, who you are as a man or something, or was it mainly from the family members and other relationships you had at that time?
I think it was from the family members and other relationships I had at that time. I don't think it had any. I think if I did not have the family members and the relationships that I had at that time, I probably would have died of an addict.
Yeah.
Died an addict. Because I mean, there's still time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to now, but like there's still time to die an addict, so. But it's, I don't want to at this point. I used to like, it used to be, it was like, this could be kind of nice.
Right, you chose to fight.
Yeah, I chose to fight. I chose to fight in the war on drugs, side of drugs.
Nancy's proud.
Yeah.
Now, how do you go about rebuilding those relationships?
Some of them I didn't even get the chance to.
Yeah.
Some of them... we're like such close relationships, like parents, sister type thing. And I think that I got the chance to rebuild those by showing that I gave a fuck
mm-hmm.
and like showing that I wanted to live and that I wasn't just trying to waste away my life. And, you know, it's, you know, if that's, if anybody out there is listening to this that's struggling with addiction, that is struggling also with rebuilding relationships, showing that you give a fuck is the number one thing. You have to show that you, 'cause to the people that love you and that you want to love you back, you have to show them that you give a fuck about your life. And you can't just fake that. You can't just put a smile on with that one. You have to really actually truly give a fuck about your life.
Right, especially when it's family members, because so many of them, I mean, this was super prevalent with my mom, is all she wanted was for me to do well. Almost all of her anger, her frustration, the things she would bring up when I was kind of spiraling with consistent drug use was, you know, her main issue with it always was that she was worried about me and constantly concerned. And the arguments we would get in is that, you know, Jacob, you're gonna kill yourself. Jacob, I don't know what's happening to you. Jacob, you're going to end up in a ditch somewhere. And it was those types of conversations where she was consistently frustrated with my, you know, over-drinking and over-smoking, and I had ended up in the hospital once. And so, you know, she had a lot of concern. And trying to argue with her never worked. It wasn't until I started making better decisions and choices in my own life and, you know, showed that I was going to take care of myself that she finally kind of let up on me. And it wasn't the rebuilding the trust and the relationship wasn't so much with me doing things to appease to her. Everybody's situation's different, you know. Most of my drug use was very separate from my family. I hadn't gone out of my way to intentionally wrong her at that time or, you know, steal from her for using. So some people may find that rebuilding of trust varies. I definitely had some issues with lying at the time. So there was a little bit of that, you know, where she didn't trust that I was doing the right things. But as I continued to, you know, make some steps and improvements, that's when I think the trust started to come back a little bit, because all she really wanted was my best outcome.
I think that's, and that's important to realize, is that that's all they do really want for you. The ones that love you, the people that truly love you, all they want for you is your best outcome, for you to be the best version of yourself that you can be. And that's tough for anybody to accept, that they can be the best version they can. There are a lot of people, I've suffered from this my whole life, of like fear of success, even. Of like and that probably also contributes to relapse, of like, well, this thing, I saw that all the time with my friend Malik, who, may he rest in peace. You know, he was a good friend of mine who passed, unfortunately, a casualty of the war on drugs. And he always would relapse during his best times. He would like make a big sale at work or something like that. And then I'd like find him knotted out in his car. Mm-hmm. And I was like, bro, like, what are you doing? And he was just like, I don't know, man, I felt like I could celebrate. And it was just like, and I think it came from a place of like, I'm doing, like, I'm not this good. I'm not good enough for this.
Right.
And I think it came from a place of self-loathing, because I hope one day to write a story about him that I can make into a film, because he's a very, you know, an interesting figure in that war on drugs, in the sense of just as the casualty of it, and the story of a casualty of, you know, he left behind a daughter, he left a family that loved him, and the daughter's mother passed of a drug overdose too. So think about, you know, her.
Is that prior to his passing, or did that come after?
Prior to his passing.
Yeah, that's brutal.
Yeah. So that little girl's lost both of her parents to heroin. And that's not fucking, we will eventually get a full topic, a full talk on the opiate epidemic and everything like that, because that is a very deep topic that needs to have some research done into it.
And something that you and I have both found a community that's kind of based in harm reduction.
Right.
And so we're quite surrounded by people who've come from that life and started seeking out alternatives. Because, yeah, I mean, it's brutal. And especially nowadays with the fentanyl issues. I mean, the opioid epidemic long predated this overrunning of fake pills, and then that just absolutely multiplied the amount of casualties we saw from it. Absolutely. It's already destroying families. Now it's just killing people left and right at a terrifying rate.
Yep. At a terrifying rate. What was your mental state like? And how did it change before relapsing?
So I'm kind of, I think, more in line with what you discussed as well, of like, I would have these really dark moments and just a lot of shit going on, and then have an impulse decision and kind of snap. Whether it was with drinking or smoking, those were the two things that I had the most issues with, was alcohol and weed, going back and just derailing my ability to function in life.
Uh-huh.
And for me, those two things always came after something fell apart in life, and I just couldn't deal with the stress anymore. One of the things that I got back with when it came to drinking and smoking was right after I left the PLC program I was in college. It's a platoon leader's course. It's a Marine Corps officer's program. I was in that. I got injured while I was playing rugby. I was like, all right, this probably isn't going to work out. Started really evaluating myself, like, what am I doing here? Tried to make one last effort at school, get through my summer classes, made a stupid-ass mistake, flunked my last couple classes, and I was just like, fuck it, what do I do at this point? And I just kind of, you know, gave up mentally. And one day I was like, I have to get fucked up. Like, I have to. You know what I mean?
Is at that age and that mindset, that is a logical answer to that question.
Right. I felt that way too.
It feels logical.
Because it was like, what else do I do? I can't mentally process this. So I'm going insane. I'm sitting in my apartment going like, what the fuck am I supposed to do? I hate myself right now. And there's no way out of it. Like, it's gone. It's too late, you know? And so I just had this state of like overwhelming panic. And I was like, I got to go get fucked up.
Uh-huh.
And then I started drinking and smoking every day for months.
Yeah, makes sense.
And it was like, once I went the first day, it's like then the next day comes. And you're like, all right, well, I didn't handle it yesterday. So then you sober up, and then the same shit's still sitting there. And I'm like, I got to get fucked up again. So I would do it again.
Yep.
And then weeks would go by, and I'd sober up and be like, dude, what am I doing with my life? I've lost all the opportunities I had because of my stupid decisions. And where do I go from there? Right back to, you know, getting fucked up. Which, I mean, I went a good several months without being sober. I mean, it was smoking or drinking as soon as I woke up, always having a bottle in the room, you know, almost every night of the week, having friends, you know, one or two of them, my cousin and my buddy over, and we just sit in my apartment and drink, you know. And I couldn't find a way to process that emotionally. The other time, too, my other major return back to daily use, I had kind of started taking a break, starting to go to therapy while I was still in college. And I went and I had this therapist, man. And, you know, God bless him. He's probably one of the best at what he does. But it was too good for me at the time.
Right.
And he made a couple comments to me. I don't know if I've discussed this on past episodes, but he made a comment to me, something along the lines of, you know, what makes you happy? And I had been in and out of months of just, you know, no sobriety, and then, you know, starting to kind of face it and just overwhelmed with anxiety and, you know, being mentally freaked out. And so I didn't have an answer for him. And he's like, what makes you happy? And it can't be other people's happiness. And I was like, I don't.
That's such a fucked up question.
Yeah. And I was like, what do you mean, dude? And he's like, you don't have things that bring you like joy. You don't go out and do stuff. And I was like, I don't know, man. And I couldn't answer, and I, you know, started tearing up, and he was like, what weight are you carrying that's so heavy?
Yeah.
And it shattered me.
Yeah.
And for, like, the next week, I stayed in a decent place, but it was slowly falling apart, where it just kept rattling through my head every day. What am I carrying that's so heavy? What am I holding on to? Why do I feel this weight? I don't know. And after about a week of it, I was like, fuck this. And I decided I'm never going back to school. So I didn't ever officially drop out. I just stopped showing up.
Uh-huh.
I was like, fuck this. That was also around the time where I, you know, turned away from a lot of the relationships I had in life. And I kind of cut off damn near everybody.
Yeah.
Just went into my own lair. And, yeah, went into, again, back right back into that daily using every day.
Uh-huh.
And so that the mental state, and is as short of a way as I can surmise it, is always, you know, the relapse is always predated by chaos. Is that there's some sort of internal thing that I can't control, or external thing that I can't control, wherever it is, and either way it's causing me this turmoil. And if I can't solve it in that moment, the easiest way always is to try and numb it, you know. So yeah, that's probably the best way I can wrap that up.
Yeah, I agree. That's the only one I really have. The only question I really have left is: did your perspective on sobriety change after relapsing? Even if it meant change after coming back to sobriety, of whatever that means for you. Sobriety, I also want to say, is a relative term.
Yeah. If I'm being 100% honest, I can only say that every time after going back into heavy drug use, until the most recent time, but every single time leading up to this point in my life now, sobriety just felt more and more and more like a burden and a challenge. Mm-hmm. And I was in the same mindset as you. I mean, when I was in high school, my plan was I'd go away to college and then I'd just OD or get into a car crash and that'd be the end of it. And hopefully I'd find a way to make enough money on the side that, like, I could pay my mom back for being a pain in the ass all those years. And I just wanted to, like, all right, I'll find a way. I'll go sell cars or boats or something. I'll go to, you know, FIU down in Miami. I'll sell boats on the side, and then I'll pay off my mom's house and I'll die in a car crash. And then when I got to college, I was like, all right, I'll make it till 25, and that's when I'm done with this shit. And so, you know, like, the same as you, I was traveling with no bags packed, and then got to the destination. I was like, fuck, I don't have anything I need. What do I do here? And that was what sobriety was for me every time, where I was like, well, I have to get sober. My mom's going to cut me off, and then I'm homeless. Or, you know, I don't have any other options. I can't get through work. What the fuck am I going to do? So I'd force myself into it, and then I'd end up standing there sober going, fuck, I got to do this again. Like, every time it was this really brutal position to be in. It never felt rewarding until I finally got to the point where I, you know, was just at my breaking point with drugs, and I was like, all right, I got to get off this shit. Mm-hmm. And that's when, you know, I stepped into where I am now. And now I don't really have much of a desire to drink. You know, I've gone back a couple times a year on very light occasions.
Right.
With, like, my brother in town or something, not getting fucked up, just having a couple drinks. But before, that was never an option for me. I had to binge drink every single time.
Right.
But now that turmoil has been a little better reassessed, I've been able to handle it. Which I can't recommend to all people, of course.
No, everything's different.
That can be very disillusioned too, of like, oh, well, I'm good now. And then all of a sudden you're fucking right back to square one. So I don't want to recommend
There's something that. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that says something along the lines of, the man who is able to have that one or two drinks again and then set it back down is something along the lines of, like, is a blessed man.
Right, right.
It's like, it's that man may live there, may live somewhere, but that man might not be you.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's any real way of knowing, too.
Because not until you try it out.
For right now, you may
you
be...
You may not want to try it out.
Right, if you're a past alcoholic or drug user of any type, and you go, now I'm good. Now my life is better. I had this a lot, you know, as we discussed, more along the lines of mental health with, like... if you want to call it a relapse or falling back into with depression and these really dark spirals of life, a lot of times I got to a point where I was like, I'm good. Like, I got out of it. I'm fine now. Like, my life's going good and I'm taking care of shit. And then inevitably something would happen. And I'm like, oh, fuck, no, I'm not. You know what I mean? And I'm right back to square one.
Right.
And so that can happen too with drugs, where it's like, all right, well, I'm good. I can drink socially again now. And you put yourself back around these things because you think you have this control in your life. And then the next thing you know, something happens. You lose someone you love. You lose your job. You get caught up on bills. Whatever the fuck happens. And then all of a sudden that social drinking you thought you were capable of goes right out the fucking window. And you're back to, you know, the heavy overuse.
Sure.
So for some people, especially if it's been incredibly destructive in your life, the only thing I can recommend is trying to entirely abstain from the things that led you to where you're at.
Right, absolutely. I agree with that exactly.
for you and your experience with relapsing and then getting back into sobriety. Have you ever felt like giving up on sobriety pretty close to around the time when you relapsed and then getting back on track?
Well, yeah, because when you start back up again, it feels fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Like, at least it did for me. It was like, it felt like, oh, fuck yeah, what have I been doing? Like, I love the taste of beer. The alcohol feels so good. Like, oh, man, the cocaine, the way it smells. Like, it just, like, all of, and, like, the way it feels, like, all of it was, like, just so good when I actually came back to it. But then it just completely fucked my life up. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't that it's not that I don't like these substances.
Right.
It's that they fucking don't work for me.
Yeah.
They do not work for me. I think that's really important for anybody to recognize, is that what works for you and what works for other people, that's great for other people, but you want to be in charge of you. Mm-hmm. You're only in charge of your own reaction and your own interaction with other people.
Right. I think it's important too, because it's very easy to get into the mindset of demonizing the things around you. And I think, at least for my personal experience with mental health and drug use, the best thing that ever happened for me, the best trick I ever learned, was, I don't want to say internalizing, but rather giving myself internal control over these things. The more I tried to externalize it and blame it on the things around me, the more out of control I felt. They're like, oh, it's the substances, oh, it's the circles, oh, it's the people. And then, as the saying goes, wherever you go, there you are. And so I just go, this thing is bad, I'm going to go somewhere else. And then there'd be a different thing, and I'd pick that habit up. Or I'd pick up a different habit of isolation or, you know, disassociation and still not getting my shit done. And so when I would stop doing that, stop trying to blame it on the things around me, and just go, it's not this substance, it's not this circle, it's my ability to deal with it. As soon as I did that, it gave me something internally that I could work on. Without it, I was just kind of helpless to it. And then it's a really defeating feeling. But I was like, oh no, this is my personal relationship with it. This is my experience. This is my inability to cope.
Right.
It just, like I said, it gave me a mountain to climb. And then I had purpose in changing my behavior and trying to understand myself more. It made self-work feel more rewarding. I've seen this with some of the very close people in my life that have, you know, gone through these really dark spirals, where certain people, when they get in the deep within addiction, and you're trying to just show them, here's all the things outside, or one of the best examples I can give you, I've talked to a lot of people about this, when you're suicidal and someone says, think about all the people that love you, think about your loved ones. It's like, if I'm suicidal, do you think I give a fuck? You think I haven't thought about that?
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, think about, what would your mother think? And it's like, you think I give a shit? This is about my pain. This isn't about my mom's.
Right.
What the fuck are we talking about here? And so it was like, trying to externalize it like that always just made it like, so what? You're just giving me one more thing to worry about. I already feel overwhelmed, and now you're putting more people's emotions, on my plate.
People, and like, I struggle with this myself, the idea of suicide as being selfish.
Mm-hmm.
And it is inherently at its root.
Right, it is.
But it's also, it's, to do something like that is also selfish.
Mm-hmm.
To say that, well, what would your mother think? That is selfish, because they're digging at, what can I say to this person to get them out of this?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want them to think that I care enough. And it's like, so I'm going to give them a guilt trip. Because that is a guilt trip.
It is. 100%.
I mean, and as fucked up as the topic of suicide is at any time, it's like, it's important to recognize that it is inherently selfish.
Of course. And sometimes, too, I think that the mental process you get into can feel selfless.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for me, I had really gotten to a point where I felt like I was doing the right thing for my family by walking out. Where I was like, I'm too much of a burden on everybody else around me. And I convinced myself that I was better off that way. But it was really just because I was tired of that pressure of trying to be good for them and feeling like I was constantly letting everyone down. And I think about this a lot with, you know, my father. A couple months ago, I finally watched the video he left behind.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. It was like a 50-minute video of... his final words to everybody before he
Has anybody else in your family watched that?
My brother is the only one.
Okay. Did he watch it after you?
He watched it before I did.
Okay.
Interesting. We're going to see if this... we'll see if my mom watches this. My mom doesn't know about this yet.
Fair enough.
But the point is, watching that when I was young, you know, I had all these thoughts of like, he clearly didn't love us. Because if he loved us, he wouldn't leave. And then I watched this video, and I'd kind of already come to grips with it a little bit after dealing with being suicidal in my own right. But listening to the way he talked about us and, you know, how happy he was and seeing the smile. And I was like, this is a person who's very clearly convinced themselves that the world is better off without them, and that he couldn't deal with it anymore. He'd reached his breaking point. It was over. And so I don't think that, like I said earlier, any amount of going, hey, look at all the other shit, look at your kids, I don't think that would have reduced the burden in any capacity. I think it only would have increased that. And so whether it's addiction or depression, because I think the two are innately tied together a lot of times, I just think that externalization sometimes kind of removes your ability to feel like you have any control over the situation. And sometimes going like, hey, you can be good for your kids. Like, you have that capability. Look at all the things you've done that is good. You can do more of that. You're capable of that. That is so much better, at least as a man, and for the experience I've had with my friends that were, like, literally on the ledge of killing themselves. That was always the thing that kind of turned it around. Mm-hmm. It was like, hey, dude, you have the power to fight through this. It wasn't, oh, dude, look at what a piece of shit you'll be to everybody else, you know? Like, that doesn't make you feel very good. But if you go, hey, like, you can take charge over this, it gives you a very different perspective on the possibilities in life. I don't know if you ever had that experience with what you learned in rehab centers, if that's a kind of a common theme or if they address it a little differently, but I'm curious to hear.
No, it's pretty spot on with that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty spot on with that. It's that you have to take the, like, that's one of the things that, like, that's what, and this goes into our question last week of the higher power thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things they tell you of why you want to have a higher power, because you have to lower yourself. You are not the most important thing on this planet, and that's the thing with the higher power. I've been told even if you're going to just say, like, it's the ocean, something that is more powerful than you are. It has to be that. It has to be something, because if you have the idea that humans are God, and humans are may have been created in the image of God, but they definitely are not God.
Right.
And they may be the gods of their own creations that they can create as an artist, but that's also what our God is, the artist, mm-hmm. at least in my mind, and it. Yeah, it's, I don't know, I'm getting off track a little bit there.
I like where you're going with it. I think that what I could add to that is that if you believe that you are that, if you believe you're God, it gives you this innate sense of pressure.
Right.
And a lot of times, it's power and pressure are not the same thing.
Correct,
and
yeah.
Having the ability to change a situation without saying, you have to change the situation, is two very different outlooks. And that whole, you know, if you are trying to be your own God and it's like, all right, well, I'm the biggest thing in my world and I'm failing, of course you probably want to walk out, because you're supposed to be the highest thing around, and then all of a sudden that falls apart. And I wonder a lot if that was something that played into my dad's passing, because he was an atheist. Okay. And he made a lot of comments about
it.
Yeah,
that makes
sense.
And
this is kind of like, in the video he talked about this, like, essential nothingness, and that everybody's a sheep, and what can I even do here? And it was this very, like, given up on the world. Like, he had lost any sense of power over the ability to change where he was. And he was like, I just can't get past this. You know, one of the things, I mean, he talked consistently about not being able to get out of debt, right?
Right, that's a scary one.
And also to add to this, because it's pertinent to the topic, my dad was a heavy drinker.
Yeah.
You know, not the... abusive alcoholic. He was pretty good to me when he drank. Usually he kind of lightened up. It's one of the few times he would get, like, really giddy about shit.
Yeah,
but he drank frequently and a lot when he did. And during this video, one of the things, and before that, from what I've heard from my mom, he talked extensively about not being able to get out of debt. I found out later in life, my dad had a little over $7,000 in debt that was owed on his personal stuff. He committed suicide the day before Christmas Eve. On New Year's Eve, a week later, his company reached out and said, hey, he was due to get a $14,000 bonus. We want to give it to you guys. Oh, so he had the $7,000. He's like, I can't spend money right. I'm always behind. I'll never pay everything off.
Jesus Christ.
And then a week later, it's like, here's double the amount you need. And I think if he had a little bit more of the sense of like, nah, dude, you can do this. Like, you'll be all right if you just get the right habits down. You'll be good. I think that that would have been so much more than the idea of like, all right, well, I don't have enough money for my kids, and I'm never able to pay on alimony, and this constant stress and pressure, which is a very easy cycle to get into.
Absolutely.
You know, that just the perspective got lost. And I think he felt like he was supposed to be in control of everything, and he couldn't be. You know, we can't be as humans, and you're going to be a mistake. And if you think that you're God and you're the biggest thing and you're fucking up all the time, you probably feel like a pretty shitty God, you know? That's an awful feeling.
Yeah.
So one of the last questions I'd really like to hear your opinion on. What do you think the best way to approach relapse is without shame, but also without letting it spiral?
I mean, it's not a shameful thing. You probably feel shameful doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I don't think it's shameful. I think I also, there's a difference between relapse and lapse. Mm-hmm. If you have a lapse and you just, fuck, dude, I drank last night. All right, let's start a new day. Today's a new day. Today's day one. I'm not drinking today. Every day is a day where I'm just going to make the decision to not drink again. Mm-hmm. Because I've done this before, you've done this before. You know, you've gone through the every day is a new day, and I've got to not drink today. You've done that before. If you got that far, if you quit drinking once to at the point where you had to relapse, then you had to do it once before, which means you can do it again.
I liked it a lot.
And it's but it really is truly just like start the next day.
Mm-hmm.
You can't give yourself time to just party. You can, like, look, a lapse is not the biggest deal in the world. It sucks. So when it happens, if you feel shame, it does suck. But guilt and it doesn't feel good.
No, it sucks.
Sometimes it's relief because you're carrying this, I don't want to be sober burden. But you may need to get rid of that because that's ego.
So here's one thing I'm really curious. Have you ever done the chips with any of the...
With
like sobriety chips?
Alcoholics Anonymous, yes, I have.
Okay. So just based on that thought, and we're not judging, whatever works for you, absolutely. But in your personal opinion, do you think that that idea of counting every day adds to the pressure, and that like it can kind of add to that burden? And like, more importantly, does it make a relapse feel worse?
It makes a relapse feel worse for sure.
Because you're like, all right, I built up all these chips, and I fucked up. Because rather than, all right, you had one bad day in the last 180 days, you're now at day zero when you had day 180. Because that does seem to me like it would be something that could be an exacerbator of, you know, one fuck up. Where it's like, mm-hmm. Oh, fuck up, I ruined the whole fucking thing.
No, it is.
If you had a 5-year sobriety chip, yeah, and then you had one bad night, that's gone.
No, right. Absolutely. That is a contributor, I think, of that.
Mm-hmm.
I also know that it's absolutely a contributor to that.
They should have like a 3 strikes and you're out thing.
Maybe.
I don't know. Like, you only had 3 fuck ups in the last 5 years. You keep your chips. Because it just seems a little weird to me that, like, you know, if you're, let's use a real extreme example. You're 10 years in, and then one night you go out and you say, fuck it, and you have 2 drinks and it leads to 2 more. And then you have, you know, you get a little tipsy, you'll get maybe a little drunk, you go home, and then that's it. Your 10-year chip is gone. And now you're starting from zero?
Well, but I think that's also on the same side of it to be like, is it worth it for you? Right. Is it worth it for you to have a couple of drinks? Because mm-hmm. you know where it's going to lead. And so is this 10-year chip, to lose that worth your 10 years that you put in at work to not do that?
Right.
Is it worth one night of four drinks?
Mm-hmm.
Is it worth that? And that's the question. I think that's the main driver behind the chips thing is to give you a reward to be like, hey, like this is what I'm fighting for.
It's understandable.
It does make sense, but I could also see your point of it.
I can see where it goes both ways. You know, yeah. I mean, I'm sure at that time, when it comes to talking about feeling like you have power in your life, having something that's like a tangible reward or that's like actually quantifiable makes sense to me to some level. But in the conversation of relapse, it just seems like, you know, I had it with eating for a long time. I was bulimic for years. And a lot of it was that, like, I'd fuck up. I'd have to make weight for wrestling. And I'd eat, like, a Snickers bar. And then I'm, like, 0.4 over. And rather than just, all right, I'm going to have to run another half mile to make up for my mistake, I'd be like, fuck it. I had a Snickers, but fuck it. I'm going to town. And I'd drink, you know, a gallon of water, and I'd eat all this junk food, and just gorge myself and be like, fuck it, I'm already missing weight, who gives a shit. I missed weight as a junior, dog, my first tournament of the season, by 7 pounds.
Oh my god.
By 7 fucking pounds, dog.
Jeez,
I was supposed to be 195, I weighed in at almost 202, because I had gotten to a point where I was like, well, can't make it, oh well, you know.
Yeah.
And I was, like, going to be a little over it. And so I just said, fuck it. But it created this cycle of, like, really bad binging. And then eventually that led to bulimia, where I was like, all right, well, I got to find a way to cope with my binging habits. I'm just going to do the opposite to counteract it, you know, binge and then try and get rid of it as fast as possible. And then for years, that was the cycle. But it was always because every time I'd fuck up one little bit, and rather than go, okay, one little mistake, let's move forward, it was like I ruined the ability to get past that point, and I had to start over.
Absolutely, that makes sense a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get on to lighten it up a little bit. We are going to talk about our segment here, clean, but still a mess. And we're going to tell about times, at least over the past week, that we were still sober, or you know, whatever you want to call it, and yet acting not so much. I was woken up at 3 a.m. this weekend, or week, during the week, really.
Mm-hmm.
I have school during the week. I don't want to be woke up at 3 a.m.
Sounds reasonable.
By my upstairs neighbor just banging around up there. If my upstairs neighbor by any chance listens to this, you can go fuck yourself, dude. God damn. So I banged on the ceiling, and the baseball bat, and then went outside to yell at him.
Is that where you did it?
Yeah, right up there.
There are at least 4 noticeable solid marks in the ceiling, from what I can only presume is the butt of Andrew's baseball bat. So please continue your story.
Yeah, so I went outside to yell at him after that, and yelling just brutal terms at him. Okay, I'm sure that my other neighbors were not real excited to hear at 3 a.m.
No, probably not.
But yeah, that was my thing the other day.
Any resolution? Did the baseball bat work? Did the yelling work? Did you get a response? Anything?
No. And I've talked to the front desk people of like, yo, this, because it's all the time. It's literally like every night at like 3 a.m. It's like, and it's really loud and just stomping. And it's just like, and like banging, like moving furniture for sure.
What could it be?
And meth head, probably.
That's have my you only ever gone guess. Up there? And
I've gone up there and knocked one time, twice. Because I got an Amazon package delivered up there. And I like went up to go get it, and they like wouldn't open the door. Mm-hmm. I knew they were up there, I could hear them. But they wouldn't open the door.
Little fuckers.
It wasn't in the middle of the night either. It was fucking middle of the day. And it was just like, they wouldn't open. Fucking assholes, dude.
Sounds like real class act people.
Whatever, dude. Anyway, how about your clean but still a mess?
All right, man. Listen. Sometimes I'm not great at this whole adulting thing, okay?
None of us are. It's a fake thing.
Agreed. Sometimes I just don't give a shit about things enough to even know if I'm in the wrong until after I find out I'm in the wrong. So this week, your boy found out that Colorado allows landlords to terminate tenancy for late payments. I thought I was doing them a favor, okay? Because every week I pay with cashier's checks, and or every month, sorry, and every month I pay them an extra $100 in late fees. That's a win for them. They've collected an extra $2,000 off me in fucking late fees. Whoa. I pay late. Bro, almost every month.
That's not how
that works. I pay late almost every month. And I figured, I always pay before the eviction date, which is usually the 25th. Every month they get paid. They know that every month I come in on the day I'm supposed to get kicked out.
I wish we had a video of this. just to see my face, dude.
They don't like me over there.
Oh, I bet.
But, you know, again, they've gotten $2,000 off me. So I found out that if you did that late more than 3 times, I've been there almost 2 years, so it's probably happened like 14 times.
Yeah.
I didn't know that they could kick. Oh, there's your neighbor.
Yeah, that's my neighbor.
Speaking of the devil, wake him up, huh?
Yeah.
So they left a note on my door saying they were terminating my tenancy with the building, which has led to a really cool outcome. I'm going to move in with my friend. And so that's nice. I wanted to move anyhow and have a bedroom for once. Okay. And now I have someone to split rent with.
There you go.
So there's a plus side to this. That's better. It was one of those like, oh, fuck. Like, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing in this life. You know, like, I heard a knock on my door. And I got up and I'm like, who the fuck is this? It's not, I know when they come to hang the late notice, it's always on the 7th or the 8th. So this is, you know, in the middle of the month. Towards the end, and they just knocked on the building and said, are you okay? And I was like, yeah, I'm fine. What's going on? I didn't open the door. I didn't want the dog to go psycho, and I'm standing there in my underwear. And they said, all right, well, we're just checking in. Good luck to you. And then she walked away, and I was like, what the fuck did she tape at my door? And then I opened up, and I saw termination of tenancy, and I was like, oh, no, what'd I do this time? And that's how your boy found out. Not the best thing to find out. It has very quickly led to what seems to be a hopeful outcome. But yeah, one of the more embarrassing things I've had to deal with, to be honest.
That's not fun, dude.
Seeing reason for eviction on a piece of paper with my name on it was not great.
No.
Luckily, it doesn't go on my record, but
That's not good.
The conversation I'm going to have with, you know, my mom about why I moved is not fun.
That's no good at all.
Yeah, not great.
So we'll go into another topic here. We'll go into our songs of the week. It's our new little segment here. We're going to talk about a song that brings us some sort of emotion, I suppose.
Yeah, and we're still kind of figuring this out. I really like this idea because music has been an incredibly important part of both of our lives. I know you are very, very passionate about the music you listen to. Mm-hmm. I'm the same way. And so whether or not these songs of the week are going to be songs from the past that helped us get through where we were, or songs from right now that are helping us get through, we'll kind of be up in the air until we figure out what works the best.
Right.
But for right now, I'm going to start with one that helped me in both times. So one I still listen to, it's called San Marcos. It's from Brockhampton. I believe it's off Saturation 3. That whole album is fantastic. And they also have a newer album out. Drive me up a wall, I can't remember it. But they have a bunch of really great stuff about the patterns of addiction, getting through it. That one was one that kind of broke me down for the better. During the time I was really, really into it. It starts off really, really tough about, you know, like crystal meth addiction, and the song is very uplifting, and it's, you know, I want more out of life than this, and there's a very beautiful chorus. It's a fantastic, masterful song, but that was something that I listened to daily, many times a day, for months on end, when I had first started really getting into heavy use, or, you know, like daily use. It just would listen to it on repeat and sit there in a dorm bed looking at the ceiling, listening to the song over and over and over again. And as I got past that point, it's a song I've touched back on multiple times in my life when I'm going through shit. Very, you know, just one of those songs, immediately as soon as I listen to it, I feel like emotions welling up.
Right.
Which at the right times and the right conditions is one of the most powerful medicines I think you can possibly experience, you know. So let me hear about yours.
My song of the week is a song called Gild the Lily. It is by Billy Strings, my favorite artist. Gild the Lily, I had sworn I had heard that saying before, gilding a lily, and I had to look it up to see what it meant. And what it means, essentially, is to give something praise, but your praise is unnecessary because the thing is already so beautiful on its own.
Got it.
Yes. So that's essentially what I'm doing by giving this song praise. The song is already so beautiful, it's on anything I could say about this song is nothing.
Right.
But I'll just talk about Billy's ability. His ability is second to none in the ability to take a song from where it's at and in its original way of being played, deconstruct it all the way down to its nuts and bolts, all the way down to its bare bottom of the song, and then reconstruct it all the way back up to the top and go back into the original song and take 20 minutes to do that.
And for those who haven't heard him, this is while playing. This is not in musical composition. This is while he's playing.
And not like it's Billy Strings. He's playing a guitar. And the guys next to him are playing a mandolin, a banjo, and an upright bass, and sometimes they got a fiddle. And it's like, these guys are the most talented musicians in the world. And if you ever get a chance to go see, if you haven't heard of Billy Strings or if you have not seen Billy Strings, either of those two things, check them out or go check them out in person, because it's a show that you'll never forget. It's a show that's worthwhile every single time. I've seen them multiple times now, and I'd never get tired of it.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to go with you one of these days.
Absolutely. We're trying to actually go up to Montana in the summer, a couple of us, and meet Isaac up there.
Nice. Go to bumfuck nowhere?
Bozeman.
Hell yeah. Going to Bozeman. I don't know what the fuck that is.
Bozeman's a mountain town up there. It's a college town. It's actually a pretty sick town.
I'm down to check it out. Montana seems cool.
Montana's awesome.
Seems like an big easy place to die.
Yes. Yes. He's in my buddy Isaac. Shout out Isaac if you're listening. He's up in Wyoming now, and he.
Which one do we border?
That one.
Oh, okay.
We border Wyoming. Just way up. He's way up there.
Got it. Okay.
He's not anywhere near Cheyenne, which is where we're near.
Heard.
But yeah. That's pretty much all I got for Gild the Lily, because I am just gilding a lily at this point.
Nice. So, let's go into our next and likely final section of this episode. One more little comedic bit to tickle your peach. That sounds wrong.
Yeah, that's fine. It sounds good to me.
So, we're going to do the shit I did for a fix. This is a section we're hoping you guys can help us out with a little bit. Send us an email with your personal stories. DM us on Instagram. That's going to be Malfunction Junction Podcast. On Instagram, malfunctionjunctionpodcast@gmail.com if you decide to email us. But please feel free to send us your own submissions. We're going to start off by giving a couple. We may do this for a couple of weeks until we can start, you know, gathering some of these up. But we just want to give you guys a couple examples of shit that we've done for a fix.
Uh-huh.
And, hopefully that'll kickstart your brains a little bit. Andrew, you want to lead off?
I will lead off, given that I have the lesser of these two. I don't know. Mine's pretty disgusting.
Here at Malfunction Junction Podcast, we're supposed to be inclusive and non-judgmental, unless you're a piece of shit, which both of us are, so... Fine, all right. I think yours is nastier than mine, but go ahead.
Mine's pretty nasty. I don't even know how to begin to tell you how many times I have smoked a cigarette butt off the ground.
I'll let you hit my vape, you dirty bastard.
This is an addiction. I've never done it sober. This is something I've never done sober. Only...
This is drunk cigarette
butt. This is drunk, like... Or, on drugs, oh, fuck, I need a fucking cigarette. It's I bet there's one on the ground out there. You just, go out there and fucking find one.
Okay.
Just burn it.
Here's what I want to know.
Yeah, usually rip the butt off it to just smoke the fucking...
Oh, okay,
if you get a... How many times have you gone down to filter? If you're lucky enough to get a fucking half a cigarette that you find on the ground as a homeless person.
Like that's striking gold
as a homeless guy.
That's the modern day 49ers.
I threw one of those down there.
You're panning for gold in the city streets, dog. You found a nugget. Dog. It's just an that's old awesome. Fucking Virginia slam.
That's awesome.
Been sitting out in the rain for 6 days.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, no, I threw a cigarette down the other day thinking about a homeless guy. Like, I hope a homeless guy gets this.
It's your message in a bottle. Hell yeah.
I'm sending out an SOS.
You should start, if you do leave like a little half a cigarette, you should start writing messages. Just little hopeful ones, oh you know, God. Like it gets better. Because I constantly see
people. Are enough.
Yeah. Live, laugh, love.
Live, laugh, love. Awesome.
That's fantastic. Yeah. All right, so now to mine, which is far less dirty than Andrew. Dude, when I was in college and I got my own apartment, the amount of times I've just now found out, you know, as this podcast was beginning, we discussed this a little bit. It's called carpet surfing. Yes. I was not aware of this. But taking a sock.
I am familiar with
throwing
this term.
That over a vacuum. And then forking up the carpet while vacuuming over.
And I'd like to say that this is I've done carpet surfing before. This is a new form of carpet surfing to me.
It's an effective one, dude.
I'm sure it's a very effective form
don't
of carpet
do
surfing.
This if you're still in the deep, deep cycles of addiction. Don't do this. It's bad. But
drugs are bad.
Drugs are bad. Okay. Yeah. But at the time, it was an incredibly effective method at getting your money's worth. And that was just that sock over the carpet, dude. Or sock over the vacuum. And yeah. I got so much good stuff that way with my cousin. Oh, sorry, but you're in this with me now. But that, and you know, you only ever get enough for like half a bowl.
Yep.
And then you get that, you mix it with some scrapings out of the bowl. You get a little bit of that nasty, nasty butane tar resin.
I got a friend who I think is listening to this right now. Shout out Rodney.
Rodney.
If he's listening right now. Man, we could have used that in your old Ford fucking Explorer, dude. We could have. When that one time when we dropped all that weed in your fucking truck, oh my God, we could have used that shit, dude. Shop vac and a sock? Why didn't we think of that?
That's another one, too. The level of panic and immediate mental breakdown I would have when you're, like, broke and you've only got a little bit left and you drop some. Or you're like rolling something and you accidentally breathe on it and you send it scattering and it's like, oh my God. And then you're hand picking with a fucking pair of tweezers.
I remember I had one time a thought. I was like, I wish I could be rich enough to not have to worry about burning all the way through a bowl. Like every time we'd just smoke every last bit of green in the bowl. And when I was a kid, and now I didn't realize that I'd still be poor when I'd get to that point. I didn't realize that that would be the case, and I'd just eventually get like, fuck, I don't care. I'm not smoking. It's greens. Give me greens, dude. Like, I didn't realize I'd still be poor when I got to that point.
Did you always smoke it until it pulled through?
Yeah, every time.
Yeah, okay. Attaboy.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is being financially responsible.
This is being financially responsible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't, the taste is coming back to me.
Ass.
Not very happy about it. But yeah, that carpet surfing combined with keeping every used liquor bottle I had on my shelves and getting about a half a capful, enough to get like two shots out of 45 empty liquor bottles.
That's disgusting.
And the combination is really good. Something. Though. Mixing like wild turkey with Svedka. And the, you know, like skull vodka. And, oh, God, it was horrific. But at that time, I was doing anything for a buzz. I just wanted to not be sober.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that covers the shit I did for a fix example.
Well, coming up next time on Malfunction Junction, we'll have something great for you. Yes, in the meantime, go ahead and go out there and follow us on Instagram. Again, that is Malfunction Junction Podcast. All one word.
Mm-hmm.
And again, malfunctionjunctionpodcast@gmail.com for our email. Hit those lines. Give us a follow. Send us an email. We, again, are needing things for the trauma bingo.
Mm-hmm.
Trauma bingo is a big one. We're trying to come up with something for that in a couple of weeks. And then also we've got our Shit I Did for a Fix. Please send in those things. Shit I Did for a Fix is anonymous. Trauma Bingo, if you'd like to participate and you'd like to have your trauma read out on live on air.
Not anonymous.
Not anonymous. That one's not anonymous.
And the big one, too, is please send us any listener questions you may have, topics you'd like us to cover. Mm-hmm. That makes up a big bulk of these episodes. And we really appreciate talking about things that are pertinent to the people listening to these. Where are we now available on?
We are available on everything.
Spotify,
Apple, and YouTube. Huh? Amazon. And all of the little ones, like the little, like, the podcast networks that are everywhere. Yeah. We're literally everywhere.
That's sick. So find us on anything. You can watch us on YouTube. If you don't have YouTube Red, pull up Spotify or Apple, and you'll fucking listen to us while your phone's off. On the way to work, wherever. We'll be in your head constantly.
True.
Mm-hmm.
All right, everybody.
Thanks for joining us.
Have a great night.